Now, let me tell you a little bit about the next guest coming in. The next guest is Richard Gabriel. He's the author of Echoes from the Chamber. He has lived a lifetime of profound, supernormal experiences which opened his mind. His mind, a memory of how matter functions up to and beyond quantum. He offers his knowledge of how life, the universe, and everything functions, and shows how in his case this awakening was in preparation for a task of discovery he would conduct along with his twin flame in Giza, Egypt. Their calling was in pursuit of true origins as a species and for the lessons we learn from our highly advanced ancient ancestors. Figure it this way. How old really are the Egyptians? We're going to find out. Charting 50 years of profound supernormal experiences in preparation for a special task in Egypt. A decade of below-the-radar exploration beneath the Giza Plateau in the Great Pyramid with his twin flame, Judith. And a spectacular discovery. You got to remember this. Our ancient ancestors left a secret message for us, which will change your view of our origins forever. Part 3 of the book documents their explorations above and beneath the Giza Plateau over the last decade, seeking evidence that discoveries were made. Now, let me bring you, I am very proud to bring Richard Gabriel to the microphone. Richard, how are you doing?
Yeah, hi there again, Bob. It's really good to talk to you again.
I'm telling you, I love you on the show. First of all, you know, and I think everybody out there that knows, like, Egypt is a very, very, very close to my heart kind of place. And me, it was funny because she's got a hotel at the bottom of the pyramids over in Mexico. And I'm telling you, I was there. Next time I want to be invited to her hotel.
Wow.
I mean, if it's that close, I could hang out at the hotel and go back and forth to the pyramids. I mean, it'd be great.
Yeah, well, we stay in a village just beneath the pyramids also.
Oh, well, that's awesome. I mean, I've not been there yet, but one of these days, Ned, I will go. I really, really want to get up in the morning and see a pyramid.
It'll blow your mind.
Probably would. But with just seeing them for the first time would probably blow my mind.
Absolutely. You know, it does every time we see them, and we've seen them often enough now, but, you know, the wonder of it is there the minute you open your eyes to them.
Oh, yeah. Well, I said it in jest, but it's not really jest. What I'd like to do is I'd like to go over there and do a week of radio shows from there.
Oh, my God. That would be fantastic.
I mean, could you imagine? I mean, you know, get the people that are walking in and out and the people that who are visiting and everything else. And get them on, get them to sit down. What do you think? You know, and I'm telling you, man, it was like, probably be invited over by the State Department over there.
Well, I tell you what, if it could be put together, Bob, then we would definitely cooperate to open up our contact book over there and just line them up at the door.
There you go. I mean, I am really, really not kidding. I mean, somebody said to me, they said, you're out of your mind. I said, no, I'm not. I mean, it's just like, this is our history. This is where we came from, you know, really. And people don't realize that. They don't get it through their thick heads. There might have been Indians all over the whole planet. But somebody somewhere had technology that we have to this day, no idea what they had.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, over there, there are a million people with opinions, but there are a few that you can be pointed to or can be pointed in your direction that we've been privileged to become acquainted with that would actually tell you things.
Tell me about some of the, I always love to ask this, Ned, because it kind of sort of, if I close my eyes, I can see your tours. What kind of tours, Ned, do you guys do over there?
Well, we haven't organized anything on the tour side yet. We've had the opportunity to for quite some time. But, you know, I guess we're mavericks because we follow our own plans and our own agenda. And, where others, I say this kindly, but, are perhaps a little bit more in the self-promotion side of things, where we're trying to achieve something ultimately for the animals over there, as well as make the discoveries that we've been led to pursue. And it was really in pursuit of those discoveries that our involvement with the animal rescue became more than just an incidental interest or passion. It became a driving passion, and now we're solidly involved over there with ESAF, Egyptian Society of Animal Friends, with plans of our own that are detailed on our on a foundation, the Giza Foundation website, and we're actively involved in at the moment. I recently returned from a trip over there, which was specifically to deal with issues to do with the things, the initiatives that we're taking to do with the animals, and a couple of other things besides, but we may get onto those.
What type of dogs? What kind of animals?
Well, there is no distinction, but clearly the most important issue is with the camels, horses, donkeys, as the main working animals, but it does come on to dogs and other domestic animals and other feral animals that are there. It's a horrendous situation over there at the moment. The people are starving, the animals are dying. It's been a situation that has been in the offing for a long time now, because tourists are less discerning than perhaps they ought to be, or they've been taught to be. And we've seen so many instances of animals being desaddled where they have been working out on the plateau, and they're covered in sores and ulcers on their backs that people have been sitting on, the size of dustbins.
Wow.
Huge, absolutely huge ulcers and sores. And we have seen animals literally drop dead as they've been unsaddled from the plateau. What we've seen over there and what we've photographed, we've put a few pretty horrific pictures on the site, but some of the photographs that we've taken, scenes that we've witnessed, they're too horrific to share, really. It's a pretty chronic situation. I mean, there are so many elements to this. There is a matter of education where people living in poverty under dictatorship for so long, so many decades, all the instincts that were there at one time, where animals were revered as an important part of society, have now been bludgeoned into a different status. And the status now is where feral dogs who run in packs together for comfort at night time and then split up to go foraging among tourists, if there are any there in the daytime, for food or scraps, they are still illegally being poisoned by strychnine by the authorities, and one can find piles of these bloated dogs on corners occasionally, and the meat, the strychnine-induced contaminated meat, is obviously picked up by other creatures. The feral cats are maltreated by children. We've witnessed and intervened so many times where children have been haranguing and beating the hell out of horses that have been injured or dying for sport, because they're just ignorant. So we are involved with ESAF in supporting them in a schools campaign of re-education. Love your animal, the animal will love you back. Love your animal, and it will give you 10 times more back in the way of work and service. You know, that's just another aspect of it. Even simple things that we take for granted here, like farriers, farrier work. You have animals where their hooves are in such a bad state that they're completely crippled, where we've seen broken hooves, where animals can no longer walk normally because they are overgrown or abscessed so badly.
Oh,
sights
ouch.
That are just beyond belief. Donkeys, where there is no food for them. Horses, where there is no food for them, where they're just left to forage, and they're eating plastic and other garbage that is lining the road leading straight up to the main pyramid entrance. It's a horrendous picture that I could continue in description with for considerable time.
Well, the only way that people really turn around and look at things like this is if somebody mentions them, and it seems that radio seems to be the best media right now, because the TVs forget about it. They don't even want to know about it. I did a show with Vanessa, if I remember the last name, Vanessa Schultz. She did a film, a documentary film that's coming out, that's going to be in all the shows and everything else all over. It's called Lost Dogs. And that is about exactly what you're talking about in Chile.
Yes.
So, I'm sure she's probably been there too, because I know she's been all over the world.
There's such an irony, Bob, you know, because at nighttime, the dog packs on the plateau are long renowned for being watchdogs. Anyone wandering about on the plateau at nighttime, the dogs will find you out and they'll bark like hell and the guards are alerted. But in the daytime, the packs, I mean, we've observed and studied them. The packs, they split up and go solo, or there might be two together. And they go out amongst tourists when tourists are there. Tragically, they're not at the moment. But when they go out amongst the tourists in ones and twos, you'll see them walk past a watch post where there's a guard there. And instead of welcoming them, or at least being friendly to them as they go past, they'll think nothing of picking up a stone to throw at them and chase them on their way, even though they've been their friend in the night time. It's crazy, the irony of it. But the education stretches beyond the schools. It stretches to the people. It stretches to the animals themselves. We support ESAF, and we've cemented a relationship from the visit that I just had there recently. And our intention is to revive the free clinic in the village that was there until not too long ago, up to a recent time. An organization called The Brook, which is a well-known world organization, very wealthy, had supported with small donation organizations like ESAF that enabled them to have free clinics in the village, which were staffed by interns, by trainee veterinaries. When the trouble started, for reasons of their own, they dried that money up, are no longer supporting the small organizations, although their fundraising still continues. I know that ESAF, they begged them for the use of new ambulances, animal ambulances that they had, and they were just flatly refused. It is a sore point over there. So everybody, I'm quite willing to say it openly, because I know my facts to be true, that the Brook stopped supporting, and as a result, the free clinic in the village, where we'd always seen it, had to stop. We intend to revive that. We rely completely on donations and the money that we earn ourselves. I said this on the last time I was with you, Bob, that mm-hmm. Judith and I, she in the US, me here, that we live completely by needs alone. Every spare dime and penny that we have goes to getting us over there and continuing the work that we have. But we look for meager donations, I have to say, in the current climate, to come forward, so that we can progress with our intentions with ESAF. And they include the free clinic reinstatement. We are opening an actual office, which they and us, we will use when the work is being done in the village. And much of this is subsidized, partially or almost wholly donated. And our main project, which we have described up until now, to open a new animal hospital on land that has been donated to us. Now, further research and discussion with ESAF, we've refocused that a little, and I'll describe this on a report that I'm about to put onto the foundation site, where there simply is no operating clinic where horses, camels, donkeys, and such like can be operated on. Anywhere in the area, there is nowhere where they can be operated on.
There's no vets?
Well, there are plenty of vets, but they have to have, if I could describe, you may have seen this on TV documentaries, where the animal is placed between, I suppose you could call it a kind of gantry, which then takes its weight and is able to twist through 180 degrees in order to lay the animal down and maneuver it.
Oh, yeah, it's like a sandwich machine kind of sort of, but hugs the animal and turns it over.
Yes, that's right. So it needs specialized equipment, and it doesn't need to be a big place. We're not going to build a big place, but sufficient to be able to provide one of these operating clinics. And we've costed all of this out, and we're seeking to reach a target of 25,000. That's where a percentage of the money is going into the fund for that. At the moment, the only operating clinic that we know of that provides this is one that the Brook have. But the Brook will only do operations that last for no longer than 20 minutes. So if it's a larger operation, they will not do that. This is our information hot back from Egypt in the last 10 days. And also, they do not operate outside office hours. So if an animal is knocked down or anything, then forget it. You can't be operated on or dealt with in this one clinic outside those hours. So we're looking to change that completely, provide our own and make it available as a part of a partnership with ESA. So those are our initiatives. We're into also supporting another initiative to train more farriers. They only need tools. We've been able to look into, and we're seeking to help put those who can train along with those who wish to be trained. We've been able to identify both groups, and this is something that's current. If we were able to, Bob, we would be over there full time now doing this, organizing it. If our lottery tickets came up, then that's where we would be right now doing all of this instantly. But it can't be done instantly, and especially in a poor economic climate where money is short, everybody's tight, money counts for everybody wherever you are in the world. Mm-hmm. But we just beg people not to forget the animals. And if they come to our website, please, please, we're begging for support. And you can rely on us to do what we say we're going to do. We're not a big organization.
Yeah, have you ever written, Richard, to any of the animal associations around the world that could? I mean, to be a veterinarian, you have to go to training. You got to do internship. All these things. What about opening something there that people from anywhere in the world can go there and do an internship and actually work with all these animals? I mean, let's face it, they have a pool of work that has to be done.
Actually, you're ahead of us there, Bob. You're reading minds because there are facilities there which need to be upgraded for people to stay. That is a separate matter in hand, and we're in discussions with that also. But the intention is, it always has been, we've been asked for a long, long time from people that come to the website. We've had so many requests over the years to say to us, look, could you take us to some of the places that you've been to? Could you take us on a little safari or take a group? We've been saying all along, look, we want to do this, but there are certain things, a certain stage that we have to get to ourselves. Now, the impetus for that really is increased because the idea has been brought up, which everybody thinks is a good one, that as soon as we can get ourselves established with just some basics, the office and so on, then we would look to bring groups over that could actually come over on a working holiday, be they veterinaries or ordinary people, to actually work under the guidance of local experts with the animals in the village and elsewhere, and also take in a bit of the atmosphere and everything else that's there on offer. So yes, it's something that we've got in hand and we're working towards, but it takes time, it takes money, and we can only go as fast as we can, but we're in it for the journey.
How about the audio? Well, you have there's all kinds of organizations that right now and that are giving into Egypt, and even though Egypt seems to be, and I'll discuss this in a second, but it's not the best place in the world net to go to the center of town, that's for sure. But if any one of those organizations from around the world wants to send someone to learn as part of their education, they should be able to give some kind of a grant or something to be able to let you build what you have to build to their specifications to send their people to learn how to work.
Yes, that's absolutely true. I mean, I would say to you once again, I mean, for all our grand designs, they may sound grand designs, but believe me, when you're on the ground and you talk to people, talk to them on a ground level, then these things are the things that are required. These are the things that are real and are needed. And although we're small fry at the moment, I'll roll the clock back. The reason why the Giza Foundation was incorporated in the first place was because over the years of us going over there to do our work, where we were led to go, in the archaeological research, we encountered so many situations where we were compelled, because of our passion for animals also, to intervene in situations. And we got ourselves into trouble many times. Now, we talked about that a little on the site. And then out of the blue, a couple of years ago, we were approached by an American corporation who offered us $10,000 for this work.
That's all?
Now, to us at the time, if you got nothing, it's a lot of money.
Oh, okay.
Now, we were bowled over, completely bowled over, and we thought, first of all, it was a hoax. But I did my research and found that it was quite genuine, but it was a corporation, and whether it was tax break or whatever, I don't know, but it was a genuine charitable offer. Now, we were just two private individuals. We weren't incorporated as a company. There was a very small time frame where this offer was live, and we just couldn't meet the criteria. We lost the offer, and it broke our hearts. Because we knew what we could have done with that. We already knew of the things, some of the things at least that were needed over there. And it completely destroyed us when we couldn't accept the offer. So we knew at that point we had to go forward and actually create an official body. We searched and found that the Giza Foundation was a name that was available. It was incorporated here in the UK for the purposes that I described. Now, at this very moment, it is being incorporated in Cairo also. And in due course, America will follow. And when it's incorporated officially, which will be within the next short period of time, we'll sign the paperwork when we go back next time. Then the full charity status will be able to be gained. And then we can start seeking help from the places that you've described. The larger corporations and groups are out there, of course, but you need to have some sort of grounding, some sort of clout, so that it's obvious that you're quite serious and that you've put an infrastructure in place that will work. If anybody out there is listening to this,
they're listening, all right. They're already writing. So,
if anybody out there is listening, who has an interest, a passion in this direction, who wishes to help, who has the ability to help of a larger nature, who wanted to go out there on behalf of their company or anything else, then we would be more than happy to be play hosts to such a person or persons on behalf of, if they wished to investigate in order to perhaps become involved and make company decisions in this direction. So who knows? I've said it now, and we can only wait and see.
Oh, there you go. We're going to take a little break for a couple of seconds, and that when I come back, and that there's a bunch of stuff on the chat box here and that from you that's already coming from John, who's already getting to get in touch with you. Now, one other thing I want everybody out there to know. The book that I was saying before, Echoes from the Chamber, first of all, I recommend it only because I'm an Egyptian crazy guy. I mean, it's like, who knows? Maybe I was there 1,000 years ago. My spirit was there. Whatever. I mean, it's like I've been there, but I haven't been there. The book itself describes Egypt to you, the pyramids, and all about them in a way with love. Like they love to talk about it. And this is what this book is about. Now, let's talk about the book a little further. The book itself, 100% of what goes from that book goes into doing what Richard's talking about, to building the places to take care of the animals there.
Yep.
So, if you buy the book, you're instantly helping them to build what they need to take care of their country.
Yep, that's right.
So yeah, there absolutely. You go. So what we're going to do is we're going to be back in a couple of minutes, and we're going to talk a little bit more about this. John, hang out. We'll be right back. And don't forget, the Bob Charles Show is now the Bob Charles Morning Show on Tuesdays and Thursdays at 10 o'clock in the morning on Pyramid One Network. Thank you. See you later.
Right now. talk at the
Do you remember watching Murder, She Wrote with your mom? It's like that. ConnecticutHiFi.com Community Radio, bringing back that warm, fuzzy feeling.
Surprise the love of your life with the meal of their dreams. Why fight traffic, weather, waitlists, annoying waiters, when the best of Charleston can come to you? Chef Michael Fennell has over 20 years of culinary expertise to please your palate. Enjoy a romantic getaway in the privacy of your own home. Pricing is much more affordable than many downtown locations, and gift certificates are available. Simply visit cookingforcouples.co, cookingforcouples.co, or call Chef Michael 843-714-8693. 843-714-8693.
The Cardinal James Show, when you're ready for the last resort. It's Water's Ledge.
Seriously, how many men?
Shh, buy me something.
Who's going to stain on it?
That's just sweat. That's not diamond salt. Crystals, it's actual salt. Crystals, it's actual diamond crystals. Blood diamonds.
Isle of Palms. That's where I want to be.
No, he was like, we're going to
It was a sheik and a...
And the other guy was going, why are you spitting? What's wrong with you?
What's wrong with you?
Don't be a punk. Don't text your junk. The Cardinal James Show. Friday afternoons, 5 to 7. Only on Kinetic Hi-Fi.
We got talk shows. We got sunglasses. We got music. We got fake Rolexes. KineticHiFi.com. Keep it locked in, honey butter.
Oh, yeah, you got the Bob Charles Show right here. And it's Sunday. You know it's Sunday. It's got to be Sunday. Hey, listen, you know it's after 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and we're having a good time and listening to Richard Gabriel. He's over in UK. Yeah. And everybody else that's out here. Now, we have people, I'm telling you, Australia is talking up a storm in that over here. We were just talking about the Giza Foundation. Richard, when you decided to do the book and put the book, you know, so it paid for some of the stuff in it that you're doing over there, didn't that kind of like take away, you know, some of the things that you're trying to do or some of the money you're trying to earn too?
Hell no. I mean, the actual amount that comes from the book is a pittance.
Really?
It's a joke.
You got to be kidding me.
That's right, yes. You know, you start to earn a little bit if you do a second or third.
Right.
But, or if there's big distribution. But as a first book, you know, you have to be realistic. And no first book is going to be a bestseller unless you're already a well-known name. So you find that the royalties are very small. And, you know, we'd made the decision anyway beforehand that whatever we did get from the books, we would plow it back in. It would have been nice to have thought that we would get some more. Nobody became a millionaire from a first publication, especially if it's on a serious work, which I hope that those who've read it will agree it is.
Well, some of the things that I got going on here, coming in on the chat box, is there a tunnel system under the Sphinx, Richard?
Yes, I caught all that. I guess for those who've just tuned in, Bob, it might be worthwhile just sort of scratching back a little bit to the first slot that we did together.
Go right ahead. Go right ahead.
I think what I would say to start with is that if anybody's got anything to say about something like this, discoveries of any kind, I know whenever I'm reading somebody else's material, and I find that it's wrong to take it at face value. You have to, first of all, do a little digging and find out what the pedigree is behind it. You know, you have to check the audit trail that led to the person giving that information in order to challenge it really within your own experience.
Or checking up on their homework.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I think that's fair. I think anybody would agree if they're serious. And it's no different from us. I mean, it's almost fanatical with us. All of our experiences have been as a result of us being, I don't know what the word is, not induced to do what we're doing or maybe driven to do what we're doing. It's a direction that's, well, I'm going to fall back on the best analogy that I can think of, and I gave it last time. It's a bit like the Close Encounters of the Third Kind movie, where Dreyfus and a whole bunch of other people find themselves waking each day with a sort of a driven impetus to build strange
mountains.
That's right, and go to the place where the UFOs landed. So there was something in their mind, in their presence.
The Devil's Peak. Yeah.
And that's really the way it's been for us. You know, our direction and everything, our interest and everything has sort of led us and driven us to what we do. So our pedigree extends to where Judith and I came together some 13 years ago in this life to as twin flames to pursue these aims. Prior to that, I regard that my lifetime from birth through childhood, as with Judith, was a school. A learning ground to understand the, I call supernormal experiences that were always a part of my life, which, as I said before, included all the sort of stereotypical descriptive experiences that one might have heard about in this subject area, out-of-body experiences, precognition, spontaneous clairvoyance, and so on and so on and so on. And all of those were an obsession to me. It was like my head was on two levels. You know, the mundane level where you were just getting on with life, trying to become a person. But on a higher level, even from a very, very small age, thoughts and ideas were in my mind that really one would not have expected to have in the mind of a young child. And it wasn't really until the age of about 30 that I had my, I'll call my event, my experience, which essentially, it was while I was working in Berlin in Germany, during one night time, I leapfrogged from experience to experience through my life, each time seeking to understand what had just happened, gaining a little bit of understanding, then getting to a position of impasse, where things that were put in my path that helped me to understand the previous things were drying up. And it would drive me crazy because I had thoughts and ideas in my head. Why does this work this way? How does that happen that way? Why are we doing this, and why is that happening in that way? And I would go crazy on it. And then something would come along which would give me a direction that would help me to understand and take it further. But in Berlin, in Germany, I had a monumental event or experience, which, again, I use analogy. I describe it a bit like Schwarzenegger in his movie, where he has total memory recall.
Yes.
I had a memory recall, but it was as if a complete memory was being given back into my head, or suddenly, instantly, from sort of semi-asleep position, was back inside my head. But it was like having two separate memories in my head, and I had to integrate those somehow. I feigned illness from work, and for a whole week in Berlin, I just walked the streets and the suburbs and walked around day and night, throwing question after question from my mundane mind at this understanding of how things are, how matter functions, to try and really try and trip it up, to try and question it and to see if it worked or not. Was I going crazy? Why me? Why have I suddenly got all this in my head? Why is everything being answered? How can it all be being answered? And I threw everything at it until I was completely exhausted, and I slept. I slept and slept and slept and slept and slept. And really, from that time to this day, I don't relax for a minute. And anything and everything that I encounter on a daily basis, I roll it through this understanding. It's within me. It's a part of me. It's not mine. It's just an external understanding of the way things are, the law of one, you might say. But it is there for me to challenge it within my own experience, as we all should do, in order to check its validity. I do that all the time with anything that I encounter, and to date, I have not found a single thing that will challenge it. Hmm. And I mentioned before about the book being split into three parts, and I also mentioned that the book is throws a little bit of a curveball, because if anybody picks it up, it's called Echoes from the Chamber, and the chamber, of course, refers to the King's Chamber, the Great Pyramid, but also, it's a little bit of a play on words, because the echoes really are the reverse audit trail through my life that brought me to that. And I approached the book by explaining my audit trail for the first part up to that understanding. The second part of the book deals with all the awkward questions that other people don't or won't answer. There are a zillion people out there, God bless them all, who have answers and understandings of a spiritual nature, and that's wonderful, it's great. But very often I found myself, when I was in my quest, that you would encounter situations where I found that without planning it, I would find myself at a medium's session with a couple hundred people there, and I'd be singled out and information would be given to me. But when I sought to speak with people afterwards and ask awkward questions, the awkward questions could never be answered. The simple things, as I suggested before, you know, why do babies die young? Why do good people die young? Why does this happen? Why does that happen? Why does God let this happen? And so on and so forth. All the, and there are an infinite amount of awkward questions that are awkward to answer. Well, I would propose that if there is a truth, an understanding of the way life, the universe, and everything functions, and it is based on truth, then it's invalidated if you are trying to propagate an understanding, but you wish to walk away from a single question. You have to be able to answer any question that comes your way, because if you haven't challenged it within your own experience, then you're not qualified to speak about it at all to anyone else. And that's really my attitude to life. I challenge it myself, and I expect anybody else to challenge these questions. The second part of the book it's a section that deals with all these awkward questions, or as many as I could cram into that section. And then from that, of course, I was faced with a question within my own life, and that was just about the time that Judith and I came together again in this life as twin flames. It was about that time that I was asking myself, well, what is all this supposed to lead to? Am I supposed to be some person up on stage talking about this? Am I supposed to be some sort of speaker or whatever? What point is it? What good is it doing? If this all fits together perfectly, I've got a perfect cake here which has been presented to me. What do I do with it now? And I was steered to Egypt. I had been steered to Egypt through childhood. I mean, it's part of my obsession as a childhood. Egypt, Tibet, ancient Japan, and so on, other places of some esoteric strength, which led to some quite awkward situations. You know, I mean, I one little stupid anecdote that I put into the book is when I actually built a replica of Stonehenge in my front garden.
Wow.
But I hadn't noted that my father had planted it with seed. I was too young and stupid to realize. He came home to find all the neighbors gawping at this wonderful replica of Stonehenge and his seed garden ruined, and I got a leathering for it. But it was worth it to see their faces. Anyway. So, you know, I've had this obsession all my life, but it came to fruit when Judith and I came together and we started actually finding ourselves in the most incredible circumstances in Egypt, which placed us, for example, in the village at house 13. 13 follows me through my life. I was born Friday 13th October, born 13th minute, 13th hour, Friday 13th. 13th follows me. We were at house 13, right next to where the six men were murdered. Sorry, where they lost their lives underground in the village. I nearly said the word. We found ourselves in places where strangers appeared to us and took us to show us things. We found ourselves in the company that guided us and helped us to see things that just nobody ever gets to see. And it led to our unfolding awareness of a great secret that was being concealed beneath the plateau. It led to us asking, why would this be? There's always the question, why? Why would it be so? That led us to research, of course, which has now entered the mainstream of consciousness to everyone regarding ancient ancestry or very ancient ancestry and our possible or likely connection with DNA manipulation and interference from those outside off planet. It connects to evidence that's been produced by the bucketful by people like Michael Tellinger and many, many others, which actually give credence to this ancient time. But if I bring it closer to home, we were led to experimentation in the Great Pyramid, which produced quite startling results. And then eventually to NC2. And to recap, NC2 is a tomb and a tunnel complex. NC2 actually stands for Northcliffe 2. It's on the top of the Giza Plateau, where the Harvard building is. Just beyond that, there is an eroded cliff face that leads away, well away from where the tourists go to or are allowed to go to. But there is a tomb there, and that tomb was the subject of work that was done by Henry Salt and Giovanni Gaviglia a couple hundred years ago. And their notes were recently published by the British Museum and researched by Andrew Collins and Nigel Skinner-Simpson, who discovered in those notes that there was reference to a way into a tunnel system leading down into the plateau. The notes describe how they went through a forced tunnel at a deep point that led into further tunnels, chambers going deep into the plateau. And they went out to the site and eventually discovered the crack in the back of this tomb, NC2, which leads into the tunnel system. What ensued was a bit of a debacle because Zai Hawass, who was in charge at the time, denied that the place existed, and there was quite an unsavory argument publicly, between the parties involved, which culminated, I guess, in a television production which Zai Hawass produced called Chasing Mummies, where he took a film crew down into the NC2 tunnel system, hoping to demonstrate to the world that there was nothing there of any note, anything to be seen, and that all those interested were that they were pyramid idiots.
Yeah, I was going to say, didn't they ask themselves that, well, why were they there in the first place?
Well, they didn't ask much at all. They just wanted to discredit who was there. But there are a huge number of twists, because after our first visit to NC2, which again was simply accidental, we obviously knew of NC2. The news had been broken about it. It was in the news. We'd been to Giza to our friends, and we'd been following an agenda. If you remember last time, I told you the story of where we met a watchman who spoke to us in Arabic, but understood everything I was saying in English. And
yes, I remember that. Yes,
people below ground. Well, on that visit, that's when we met him, and we had an agenda to visit him and to go out to Abu Ghraib and other places. And we were on the last day. In fact, we had an afternoon left, and the plane was leaving in the early hours of the next morning. So we were just killing time up on the plateau. And again, Judith, her intuition, once again, it's as sharp as a razor, and it's never to be disputed or to be ignored. She said, come on, we should go and have a look and see if we can find the NC2 entrance. And I didn't want to. I felt that it was too late. It was crazy. We wouldn't have time to do anything, even if we did, and we would get caught and stopped and all the rest of the things. Mm. But she was insistent. No, come on, come on. And she pushed and pushed me. And in the end, I just gave in, as
does. She knew where it was. Yeah, that's what
she
it was.
She knew exactly what the score was. And with her pushing and prodding, we just set off. I mean, we knew generally where it was, but we didn't know exactly where it was. And we just set off. Well, within about 15, 20 minutes, we were at the entrance. What? Couldn't believe it. We went into the tomb entrance and walked through to the back, found the crack, and we're down in the system. And I took hundreds of photographs going down through. I have to give a sense of what that place is like to people, because when you're standing at the entrance of NC2, and back then at that early stage, the sand blocked the entrance up to about two-thirds the door height. There was nothing blocking the door except the sand. And the sand rolled down inside, and it obliterated everything right the way inside, except the rear part of the main corridor going through. And I put onto the chat thing there a site link so that people could scroll down to the schematic that we produced from within the NC2 so they could orientate to it. But basically, going through the main corridor of the ground level part of the tomb, we found a crack at the back. And when you step inside that, at the time, there was a very large bat colony in there. And we were bombarded. It was being like being dive bombed by aircraft. And this thing about their echo sounding, allowing them never to hit you or anything, is untrue. They were dive bombing us and hitting us on the back, the front, the head, and everywhere. They've been frightened away by now. But as you step inside, there's a huge first chamber, which we've termed the first reception chamber. It's a huge, huge chamber. And inside, any light just disappears completely, absolutely disappears from a flashlight, a torch, or anything. You have to have good, strong light in order to be able to see what's happening in there at all. And anything that you get, really, unless you're well prepared, is through the flash of a camera. So we found ourselves, anyway, over successive visits, going back there, basically recording all the things that were happening that, of a wrong nature. Because after the public argument to do with NC2, Zayawas ordered that a steel grill be put over the whole of the entrance. I won't go into how we were able to gain entry once again to the place. And all I will say, as I said on the site, is that rarely will you find somewhere that has only one entrance. I'll say no more than that, and I won't be drawn on it any more than that. So I see somebody's put up on the thing, 4 minutes left. Hey, don't worry about it. We're going on for another hour, perhaps with a break in the middle. So stick with it, please.
Oh, yeah.
Find that, Bob. So... Let's just step out.
No, that's somebody reminding me.
Let's just step back a little bit for NC2. We left off a little bit last time on this. With NC2, Bob, if you stand back from the tomb, and now it's been cleared, it has this grilled entrance over it, you have hewn tombs or hewn chambers. Let's not call tombs, let's say chambers. As you enter NC2, there's a long corridor. which has niches cut into the side of it, one either side. And as you go along to the end of the corridor, you find that there's a step up, like a platform that you step up onto. It's about 4 feet high. When you go up onto that platform, on your right-hand side, there's a crack through the natural rock, which leads you into the underground tunnel network. But right beside that platform, there is an actual entrance that at one time was bricked up, but some of those bricks have been removed to actually allow a step-through entrance. Now, coming back down into that corridor, on your left-hand side, just as you step up onto the platform, there's an opening to another chamber, a very, very large chamber that's directly above a very large chamber below, one of the sub-chambers. Now, if we walk ourselves back out of the tomb again, and this time walk just inside the entrance, which was once covered by the sand, now that the sand's gone, it is revealed right and left there are stone steps that lead down to sub-chambers. Now, on the left-hand side, there's a short corridor, one chamber, then a second very large chamber. On the right-hand side, there are chambers right and left with a long corridor that curves around like a banana. Now, up above that, the end of that right-hand corridor, that is where the center of the large reception chamber is within the full tomb, within the full tunnel complex. And there's something very, very, very special about that, which we're still investigating. When you step into that reception chamber, what you find is that it's in two levels. It's about 30 feet in width, or 20, 25, 30 feet in width, 18 feet in depth, and there's a second reception chamber leading away from that in front of you. But for about half its depth, it's about the ground level of where you step through from the entrance. And what you find is there's this huge pancake rock that is supported, almost floating on two trestles that are stone trestles cut out of the natural rock. And underneath that, there's a hollow that's cut from the rock, almost like a basin or a bowl, but it has no end on the far side. So if you now walk around that huge rock and step down a couple of feet to the lower level on the other half of this chamber, you find that the natural stone where the curved bowl part opens up is cut into like an armchair with wings, armed wings to the chair. And those wings have carvings on them, animal carvings, heads carved onto them. And the seat part of it is strange also, because the stone has been cut with a channel all around it, so that if any liquid of any kind were to be running out of that bowl down to the back of someone sitting on that throne, then the liquid would actually run around the channel around them and down the side of them, down to where the feet is. It wouldn't wet them themselves. Hmm. And strangely enough, right below your feet there is underground where the corridor ends to the right-hand subchamber.